Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer in Tel Aviv. Israel has been fighting on against Hamas in the Gaza city of Rafah with deadly results over the weekend. 11 IDF soldiers killed in an explosion. The mood is grim in the country. The celebration over four hostages miraculously rescued from Gaza has dissipated. And just as that was happening, Benny Gantz's National Unity Party pulled out of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition and the war cabinet. They did that out of frustration with the lack of a Gaza war strategy and final goal and the forestalling of a hostage deal. This has made Netanyahu even more dependent on his ultra-religious and far-right partners. But none of that seems to be bothering Israel's prime minister, who was photographed with a big smile on his face in the Knesset after a controversial vote for a bill exempting ultra-Orthodox from military service, a policy that infuriates the majority of the Israeli public, was passed. We'll talk about Rafah, we'll talk war strategy, and Netanyahu with Haaretz senior defense analyst Amos Harel. After we speak with him, we'll take a look at what's happening in Europe and specifically in France, where President Emmanuel Macron stunned the nation, calling snap elections for early July. We'll be talking to Shirley Sitbon, a writer for Haaretz in Paris, about the campaign and the major role that the Gaza war and the issue of anti-Semitism is playing there. All of that coming up. Amos, hello. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for inviting me.
So the big news this week was a major, what's called a disaster in the Rafah fighting, where 11 Israeli soldiers were killed. It was very guerrilla-like. I mean, as an American, it was reminding me of Vietnam. And you wrote that the IDF chief of staff, Herzliya Levy, gave what was basically a version of the advice that Lyndon Johnson received when the U.S. got bogged down in Vietnam: declare victory and go home. Can you paint us a clear picture of exactly where we stand in Rafah right now?
A clear picture would be, I'm not sure I'm capable of that, but the situation right now is as follows. I think both the IDF top brass and Defense Minister Gallant understand that the forces fighting in Rafah, most of them conscript soldiers who have been fighting constantly for the last 8 months, are exhausted and need some form of rest. And I'm not sure that the army thinks that it knows what to do next in Rafah. What we're trying to sell to Netanyahu, as you mentioned, is a sort of an advice of declare victory and get out by looking at all of those Hamas battalions who were defeated recently and saying, well, we haven't won the decisive victory that Netanyahu wanted, but we're as close as possible right now, and we should concentrate on other things, whether it's the hostage deal, whether it's a new form of more limited focused incursions in the Gaza Strip, or whether it's preparing for the real thing, which is the possibility of a full-scale war with Hezbollah. The problem, of course, is that Netanyahu is buying none of this. The message he's sending to his followers and to the public at large is, we're still going for the decisive victory. We have great achievements in Rafah, but we need to continue. It will take as long as it takes. And he's not saying the silent part loud, but he's actually saying the hostage deal would have to wait. Look, we've done everything we can. Even the Americans are now saying that Hamas is at fault and not us. And therefore, right now, a hostage deal is not possible. Gallant and Halevi think otherwise, as far as I can tell.
Assuming you're buying what Netanyahu is saying, is such a thing as total victory possible? Does total victory mean no missiles coming from Gaza anymore? Does it mean just wiping out any organized form of Hamas and leaving the terrorist guerrilla forces? What does this imaginary total victory look like?
Look, Allison, it's absolute nonsense. And Netanyahu knows that better than anybody else because he's been in charge of this country and this army for God knows how long. This is something you sell to your hard political base in order to persuade them that you wanted fault on October 7th. This was somebody else's fault. They forgot to wake you up. The army is to blame. And right now, you're going all the way through because there's no other alternative. Now, if you want to do that, okay, do we have the means to maintain full-scale occupation of the Gaza Strip for years and years to come? Can we fight a sort of a long or an endless war against Hamas and regain control of all of the Gaza Strip and take responsibility for the lives of more than 2 million Palestinian civilians there? Do we have other things, other fish to fry currently, whether it's Hezbollah or fighting or preparing for an ultimate war with Iran? Can the economy stand under these situations? Can we have hundreds of thousands of reservists being deployed for endless time every year? This is, you know, it doesn't add up. And Netanyahu knows that better than anybody else. But again, he's selling what he can right now, because the alternative is to admit that we haven't won this, that we failed terribly on October 7th, and that in order to somehow get out of this tight situation, we need a renegotiated deal, which would include very painful concessions from the Israeli side.
What we went through yesterday, just in one quick news cycle, to me felt like a microcosm of the dysfunctional dynamic between our military, our prime minister, and his far right wing partners. And it started with the news, you know, the first news headlines of the week, that Israel's humanitarian aid coordinator for Gaza was detailing a scheduled daily pause in fighting between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. on a key route that was running north from the Kerem Shalom crossing point in order to facilitate humanitarian aid. And from there, it was like a comedy of contradictions. Can you explain what happened?
This is very typical to the Netanyahu era, and specifically the current war. There's always something, an image or a narrative you want to sell to your political base, and it's quite far away from what's actually happening. If we go back about a month ago, there was enormous pressure from the Biden administration for Israel to release, to allow more humanitarian aid into Rafah. And there's also the question of the both of the international courts in Hague, who are considering steps against Israel, whether it's accusations of genocide or possible warrants and arrests against major Israeli figures, and so on. So Netanyahu, behind the scenes, was applying pressure on the army and on Koget to deliver, to help more humanitarian aid get out. Now, this was the directive. The army never bothered to ask Netanyahu, exactly what roads are you allowing us to open for those aid trucks to come in, or to ask his permission or his approval of different steps like the one you mentioned. Once this got out, and the army are the ones who have declared this in order to persuade the international community that we're doing everything that's demanded from us, then suddenly Netanyahu was in a tight political spot with his ultra-right coalition. Also, you might remember, Saturday was a terrible day. So many casualties, as you mentioned, in Rafah and also in the central Gaza Strip. And then there was a discussion regarding the draft law and his plans of exempting so many ultra-Orthodox from any kind of serious military service. So these are means of diversion. In the end, create a scandal for a few hours, give the media what they want right now to discuss, to bite on, and then people would forget about your tricks, your political, dirty political trickery regarding the ultra-Orthodox on the one hand, or maybe think a little less about the terrible price of the ongoing war in Rafah. And he's an expert on that. By tomorrow, everybody would forget this. And yet he continues to undermine the authority of the military. And I think we'll see more and more of that because of this conflict that I mentioned regarding the future of the war in Gaza. For a week, more or less, it was a sort of a honeymoon after the army and the police and the Shin Bet delivered the success, the very impressive operation to save those four hostages in Nusrat refugee camp. Right now, you know, the hunt is on again, and we'll see Netanyahu attacking them almost on a daily basis on the one hand, and also what we call the poison machine, run by his son mostly and all kinds of supporters, what you see on social media and so on. You'll see more and more accusations pointed towards Gallant and Halevi, and also against Ronen Bar, the chief of Shin Bet.
Amos, can you connect the decision of Benny Gantz to leave the Netanyahu government and the war cabinet to the state of the fighting in Gaza and the hostage deal negotiation? After they departed, again, that was delayed by a day because of the news of the hostage release, both Gantz and his number two, Eisenkot, opened up publicly to what was going on in the war cabinet, the decision-making process over the past months of the war. Can you talk about if we learned something from what they said? Was there anything new? All things you'd heard behind the scenes, just simply said publicly. And you wrote that you thought their departure was too little, too late, that it could have made a difference earlier and it made no difference now. Can you talk about their departure and whether it has implications and what it says to us?
I think the implications, it remains to be seen what political implications will have, and whether this finally ignites any kind of massive protest on the streets, something that we haven't seen yet, in spite of the war going so wrong. It was quite clear to anybody who spoke to Gantz and Eisenkot that they were very unhappy about the way Netanyahu handled things. He was up to his old tricks very quickly after they entered the war cabinet on October 11th. And later on, especially Eisenkot was pushing for resignation and thinking that there was no way to get this done under Netanyahu, that they needed to break free and join the opposition and start fighting for new elections. And they were very unhappy, both of them, about the way the war was run. Immediately after they left, they gave interviews to all of Israel's TV stations. And in return, Netanyahu blamed them for some of the mishaps recently in Rafah and so on. For Gantz, who's very, very busy with the polls, it's mostly about finding something that would unite people around him. Right now, he thinks that this is the draft law and the anger among people who serve and their families regarding the exemption of the ultra-Orthodox. Eisenkot, I think it's more about the war and about his understanding that this is going nowhere and that actually we're digging a deeper hole every day that we're staying in Gaza and we refuse to deal with the situation up north. Where will this lead? According to the newest polls, they're actually losing support after they left. And I would assume that a lot of those votes would either go to some right-wing party, which would compete with Likud, or to Yair Lapid and Yair Golan on their left. I think Gantz doesn't have a lot to sell once he's outside of the government. But, you know, it may be the fact that Netanyahu is now stuck with the ultra-Orthodox parties and with the ultra-right-wing parties, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, would mean that this would, everything would now happen faster, because he's absolutely held hostage by both of these wings of the coalition. He's no longer in his favorite position, which is somewhere in the middle between the relative left and the right wing. Once Gantz and Eisenkot are out, there's nobody on his left. We'll see how this plays out. What I fear is that, you know, on the one hand, we're facing unprecedented problems on the strategic arena, whether it's Iran, Hezbollah, or the unsolved situation in Gaza. On the other hand, Netanyahu himself is in a very different situation than in the past.
I think the depressing atmosphere in Israel now is due to the growing knowledge that even if a miracle happened, this mythical total victory in Gaza was possible, a hostage deal happened and all of them were freed, we seem to be hurtling faster and faster to a devastating war in the north that would probably quickly spread to the center of the country. What can be done in the north? Do you see a war there as preventable, either by diplomatic means or maybe forces inside Lebanon can pressure Hezbollah to stop it? And everyone says that if it happens, it's going to be bad. Do you think the Israeli public understands exactly how bad it would be?
I still hope that it's preventable. Amos Hochstein, President Biden's envoy to the region, who deals specifically with the Lebanese front, is supposed to visit Israel and Lebanon, I think, today or tomorrow. And there will be a sort of a last-ditch attempt by the Biden administration to restrain both sides in order to prevent a full-scale war. And I think that both Nasrallah and Netanyahu know that there's a sort of a mutually assured deterrence between the two forces for quite some time. understanding of how horrible a war could be with against Hezbollah, which is much stronger than Hamas and has a much larger weapons arsenal and so on, I think the understanding helps both of them to show some restraint. And yet the fact that this has been ongoing for so long, almost 8.5 months, means that it's harder to restrain. And every time you have this, you know, things are escalating to a point where it's very, very close to a full-scale war. I don't think the public is actually aware of this. People living in the north of seeing the destruction and devastation there are, of course, aware of the dangerous possibilities. People who live in central Israel and haven't encountered anything more serious than a few rockets launched from Gaza by Hamas and quickly intercepted by Iron Dome are in for a surprise. I hope we don't get there. And again, I don't think it's the end of the state of Israel or any nonsense like that. And yet, I think that we should try and prevent such a war because, first of all, the outcome would be horrific on both sides. And secondly, in the end, since, there's no decisive victory for either side, I think in the end, the deal discussed would be quite similar to what's on the table right now. So to have to go through all of this with so many casualties and destruction on both sides and then finally reach a sort of an, not even a permanent agreement, but something in between, which won't get us very far anyway, I'd rather skip the whole ordeal. Whether it's possible, we'll have to wait and see. It depends not only on Nasrallah, but also on Netanyahu's situation. For years and years, we described Netanyahu as somebody who was risk-averse, and a lot of people on the left actually thought that this was one of his advantages, that he was not running or rushing into unnecessary wars. Right now, I can no longer vouch for that because, as I said, he's in such a different situation. He's fighting for his political life and also for his personal fate because he's trying to avoid jail time in the end for his legal problems, for the trial, for three different counts of corruption. This is the main event. When people say Israel doesn't have a strategy, that's true to some extent, but Netanyahu himself has a strategy. The strategy is remain in power and get out of jail. The problem is that his interests are no longer in line with Israel's strategic interests.
Some people say he's completely detached from reality. Do you believe that? Or do you believe, as you just described, that he is very much in touch with reality? He just has different priorities than we do in terms of protecting the country versus protecting himself politically.
I think the second answer you suggested is the right one. He knows exactly what's going on. The problem is that he's having a huge difficulty in showing any kind of empathy to the people suffering. You see the fact that he's hasn't met with people from the kibbutzim from the Gaza envelope. He hasn't gone to all of those communities that went through such horrific events on October 7th. When he goes to visit families of soldiers who died in action, he only goes to families who are ideologically identified with his camp. It's so easy to notice by now that the tricks are out in the open. He used to be more sophisticated performing those political tricks. And I think it all goes to show that maybe being too many years in power means that you create a sort of an emotional bubble of your own in which you mainly care about yourself and no longer about the people you're supposed to serve. And this is tragic, especially in a country like Israel, which is going through so many tragic events, especially under his term.
Amos, what can I say? Good luck to all of us in this situation. If Netanyahu is getting less sophisticated, at least your analyses in Haaretz continue to be very sophisticated.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you, Amos. Coming up next, we talk to Haaretz correspondent in Paris, Shirley Sitbon, about the upcoming French elections. Shirley Sitbon is a longtime correspondent for Haaretz based in Paris. She is also a correspondent for the France 24 television news channel. Her latest story up now on Haaretz.com is headlined, "What's the Intifada Got to Do with It? Gaza, Anti-Semitism, and Israel Roil the French Election." Hey, Shirley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Hi.
Can we start with the question of why the French are going to the polls in early July this year? There seems to be a huge contrast, right, between Israel, where our prime minister, who is in political trouble, is doing anything he can to postpone an election for as long as possible, and in France, where President Emmanuel Macron has called a snap election after being destroyed by the far right in the European Parliament elections. Can you tell us, why did Macron do it? Why is he risking an election now when things are looking so bad for him?
Well, there are several ways to look at it. You can think that, well, he's a real true Democrat, and he saw some kind of defeat in the European election, and now he really wants to listen to the people at home and really have a parliament that's the real projection of the voters. But from various reports and the understanding of how our president functions, well, it seems like it's a political calculation. And that's actually what he told, apparently, businessmen, according to Le Monde newspaper. He said basically he threw a hand grenade at his political rivals, and now he wants to see how they're going to deal with it. Yes, basically, his party was losing steam. There was a no confidence vote in a few months' time. And apparently he wanted just to seize everyone by surprise and reshuffle the whole political scene, taking a massive, massive bet on the situation here in France.
It sounds like it came as a surprise not only to his rivals, but to the French public, this sudden election on the eve of the Olympics in Paris. How are people responding to the fact that suddenly there's a national election right on the heels of the European Parliament election?
Well, everyone in France is in shock because, yes, they weren't expecting this now. As you've said, just before the Olympic Games, everyone's waiting for that. There are, you know, various concerns about this, and now having this election right before and right after an election. So, yes, this was a major surprise. We've never been in this situation before. Now, you talked about the fact that even those who are close to him were not aware of this. Well, we learned in news reports in recent days that some of his rivals, well, actually, they knew about his decision before his own prime minister. Apparently, some of Emmanuel Macron's advisors who suggested the snap election, well, they called some people who support right and far-right positions. And so some people on the other side, his official rivals, well, they knew this would happen before his own ministers and prime minister. And so there are actually pictures now showing how the faces of his own cabinet members, when they learned that decision that there's the parliament will be dissolved and that there will be this election, they were very surprised and shocked because, yes, they knew that they would lose steam. And that's basically the idea now, is that the extremes are really getting stronger and all of the moderate parties are really losing momentum right now.
So before we start discussing Israel and anti-Semitism and the Jewish community in France, just very briefly, the lay of the land. Who are the major players in the race? Which parties?
So what you have now on the French political scene is major three blocks. There's, for example, the bloc that's represented by the party of President Emmanuel Macron. That's the centrist apart. Then you have the left wing, from the extreme left to the mainstream left, the socialists. They managed to create this popular front in just 4 days. And then you have this big party now. Now, France's largest party, which is the National Rally, Marine Le Pen's National Rally, which used to be a small party. Now it's the biggest. And the old mainstream right, well, they're divided now between various blocs, the far right and the center.
So you wrote, "Never have Jews, anti-Semitism, and Israel been so central to a French election campaign, with officials from all parties seemingly constantly referencing them." Wow. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, yes. For example, the far right, they've been stamped and seen as extremist anti-Semites, and they were for many years. And they have some proposals which can be shocking, for example, banning kosher food, and various things. Even the kippah, for a while, they wanted to make the kippah illegal in the streets of France. So that's pretty extreme. So what analysts say is that they're trying to balance this by saying that they want to fight anti-Semitism and violence against Jews with tough sanctions against anyone who's convicted of anti-Semitism, basically just to give themselves a better image and not this extremist image they've had for such a long time. Of course, their movement is still very extreme. Meanwhile, on the far left, you have Israel and the war in Gaza playing a major role. It was the central of the European campaign, which was very odd here. But the goal, many say, was for the far left to capture new voters who are the France's Muslims. Of course, when people tell that to the extreme left or the parties of the left, they say, well, that's ridiculous. That's actually Islamophobic to insinuate that Muslims would vote more for us if we talk about Palestinians. Anyway, that was a central focus for them. And you can see them tweeting on this all the time, any of their MPs. Meanwhile, the center, Emmanuel Macron's party, they also talk about anti-Semitism a lot and about Jews because they say that they're fighting for Jew security, while the extreme right and the extreme left are anti-Semites. So basically, everybody is using this all the time.
We're used to anti-Semitism on the far right in Europe, unfortunately, but it seems a relatively new phenomenon for this to be so prominent and such a big deal on the far left. It seems, you know, kind of like Corbyn from Great Britain plus happening on the French left. Is this a Gaza war phenomenon, or is it deeper and more rooted than that, the phenomenon of what's happening on the left?
Well, it was here before as well, and there were instances in the past. But of course, every time that there is a deadly war, then yes, it takes center stage. And an expert told me yesterday that in 1982, there was a lot of anti-Semitic rhetoric on the far left, but there was no internet and no social media at the time. So it wasn't as present in the lives of everyday Jews. You know, they you didn't see it all the time. It wasn't omnipresent. Today it is. But yes, of course, the war, the images we're seeing from Gaza are so terrible that, yeah, many are focusing on that in the far left. Not even, well, there are various voices, of course, you can't generalize, but some of the MPs have only shown the Palestinian side, not explaining that it's a complex situation, that there's also Hamas in the deal, and that there are also hostages. They're really focusing and saying Israel is the sole responsible for the situation and that it must be stopped in any way. Israelis going abroad, but a soldier, Israeli soldiers going abroad must be arrested. That Israel should be boycotted, sanctioned, and even to maybe send forces to the Gaza Strip to liberate Palestine. You can hear all that from some MPs. Of course, others are much more balanced. They're saying, no, this is complex. They condemn very clearly Hamas, October 7th. So yes, you have these various voices. But yes, it was omnipresent. And really, sometimes getting all the old images from the far right, we saw this image of a Jewish MP who's a friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. So he's not much appreciated by many people in France, but he was, you know, he was called a pig many times by an MP from the far left. And now we can see a poster of him portrayed as a pig in Saturday's march against the far right.
So we're not talking about dog whistles here. We're talking about pretty blatant out there anti-Semitism, right?
Yes, I mean, it's extremely concerning for Jews so much that they're really wondering what they're going to do, especially in the second round of the vote. Because in the first round, in most areas, you have the left block, the left wing block, which goes all the way to the far left. Then you have the far right. And in many areas, you have you should have a centrist candidate. So in the first round, I think most people would vote for something that's centrist, even though they're really angry with Emmanuel Macron, who, you know, set this whole thing up and decided to have this vote. But they're still going to vote for him because they don't want the extremes, who are a threat on many levels. But the second round will be more complicated. And we've heard several Jewish figures from France, intellectuals and people who, you know, have an important voice, and they've been saying several things. Some of them have been saying they're not going to vote for anyone in the second round. Some have been saying they're going to vote for the far right, for the national rally, because the far left just scares them so much. This group, this popular front that goes from the socialists to the far left, with many people, many good people, many people who are voicing anti-Semitic voices as well. So that's the mixture is really a concern for many Jews, because they wonder what will happen once the vote is over, what's going to change. And yes, that's pretty scary for many Jews around here.
So this was all sort of triggered by the success of the right. And the French results in the EU parliament race was just part of the success of the far right in the European parliament. They're saying one out of four lawmakers now in the EU parliament will belong to the radical right now. What is going on in Europe? Is this a generational shift to the right? Is this, you know, anti-EU, anti-immigrants, anti-elite trend among the youth, with the leaders being sort of portrayed as being corrupt or detached? Is this the direction European youth is going? Because in the United States, we talk about an opposite trend where the younger generation is pulling left.
Well, it's not just the youth. It's throughout society. And yes, some decisions that have been taken in Europe, you know, they've exasperated some voters, many voters, on many levels. You can see that from everyday life, from farming, where there are many norms for like local farmers, but we import food and various products that do not abide by the same rules. So yeah, things that don't make much sense. People have been really, they've been exasperated by the situation. And so they want real change in Europe. They're not against Europe, but they want it to be different. They believe that some parties on the far right can bring that. But of course, when you hear the programs, for example, of the National Rally, there's been so much zigzagging. One day they want to pull out of Europe. When the Brexit was done, well, they're not for pulling out of Europe anymore. One day they want to leave the euro, the common currency, and then they say that's a terrible idea. The National Rally wants to do is really to discriminate against foreigners who pay their taxes here. They want to, you know, people who have double citizenship, for example, dual citizenship, they want to ban them from working in universities, in school, in all public sector institutions. So people should know that, yes, those things they're worried about, they can be resolved, but you don't have to go to the extremes to do that. But the problem is they have not found any solutions within the parties that were in government, which could have done things differently. And Emmanuel Macron, when he had these results of the European elections, and when he saw that people were unhappy, he could have found other ways maybe of finding some solutions to people's problems. But he chose the snap election.
It sounds like the Jewish community is pretty nervous and unsettled now. What are the messages that leaders of the community are projecting to the people? What are they telling them to do? I mean, maybe not ordering them who to vote for, but are they trying to reassure and calm down the French Jewish community?
Well, when you talk to them, they seem very concerned themselves. And saying, don't think about Macron as the way he used the situation. Forget about that. That was yesterday. Today, we're in a different situation. We have an election coming up. It's not because you're angry about this, about certain things in France. It's not because you're angry and dissatisfied with the president and his party that you have to choose for radical solutions. They're really calling people, you know, to make the only choice they can to make if they don't want to have people who could really change society coming to office. That's really the problem. I mean, I talked to the head of CRIF a few days ago. CRIF, that's the Jewish umbrella group here in France. And he said that the Republic principles, the values of France, the way it's managed, the fact that all people who live here legally are treated the same way, well, that's something that it's a core value. And Jewish life in France depends on this. Whenever in history, since the French Revolution, the values of the Republic were reduced, well, the life of the Jewish people in France, it changed. It was more difficult, it was more complicated. There was discrimination. So he says that the only way to maintain the basic fundamental values of the Republic is voting for the center. And that's unfortunate, because we've never had a situation where there was almost no choice. Then again, some people are saying, well, if your local candidate for the MP position is, he's just a socialist, you know him, although he's in this popular front, he's still someone you know, someone who has managed your area correctly, you can still vote for him. I mean, there are various ways of saying this, but Jewish leaders are basically saying, stay with a safe choice, remain with the center. that's, you know, it's really a first in history.
In the past, in unstable times, I know from here in Israel, we've seen these waves of immigration of French Jews, you know, due to anti-Semitism. I guess we're not looking like a very appealing alternative these days with war raging in Israel. Is there talk, as there were in other times, of rising anti-Semitism in France, of French Jews leaving the country?
Yes, yes. And figures, pretty impressive figures, saying that if the radical left wins, people who say that Hamas is a group of resistance, for some of them, they've been saying that, and people who don't condemn the fact that Zionists are being insulted instead of Jews being insulted, well, if they come to power, the situation may become too complicated for Jews, too difficult, with people insulting, you know, not just Zionists, but Jews directly, with people always saying that, you know, we can't criticize Israel because you Jews, you think you're superior to everyone. Well, if the situation arrives and there's too much talk against Jews and Israel in general, more than 60% of people said that they would leave France. But then when you ask them, where are you going to go? Then they don't answer, because it's, yeah, the situation in Israel is, of course, very, very complicated. So yes, people want to leave. Some people say to Israel, other people say, well, we can go to Spain, we can go to Portugal. They have other options. But yeah, this is very complicated. But they just don't see what's going to happen after this election. If the far left or the far right win, things could change really on a very fundamental level. And we just don't know what this will look like, because we've never had this since the war, of course.
Shirley Sitbon, sounds like you've got an interesting summer ahead of you. Thanks so much for talking to us on the podcast. And everyone should go check out your article, What's the Intifada Got to Do with It?, which details everything we've been talking about. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks to my guests, Amos Harel and Shirley Sitbon. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And if you have, give us a 5-star rating on your platform of choice so that more people can find and listen to it. And don't forget to subscribe and read Haaretz.com for all the news on Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, Shalom from Tel Aviv.